One, two, three, four.
There is some kind of magic in the creative process, and I am reaching for things in my unconscious that surprise me. I don't know what it's going to be. I like to do many, many things. It's all my life's work. But I don't want to just write the same book over and over again as some other authors do. I don't want to become formulaic.
Why are we filled with so many contradictions? How does writing help us make sense of the absurdity and chaos of the world?
T.C. Boyle is an American novelist and short story writer based out of Santa Barbara, California. He has published 19 novels such as The Road to Wellville and more than 150 short stories for publications like The New Yorker, as well as many collections of his own. His writing has earned numerous awards, including winning the Pen Faulkner Award for Best Novel of the Year for his work, World's End.
T.C. Boyle, welcome back to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Before we dive in, I believe you've selected a passage from Blue Skies, your latest book, to share with our listeners.
I would like to start off and introduce it with the very beginning of the book. Blue Skies, chapter one. They were like jewelry. They were like jewelry, living jewelry. And she could see herself wearing one wrapped around her shoulders to Bobo's or the Cornerstone and sitting at a sidewalk table while people strolled by and pretended not to notice. It would make a statement, that was for sure. She'd put on a tube top so you could see the contrast it made with her bare skin. Black, definitely black. And she'd wear her black jeans, too, and maybe her fedora. And she'd just look down at her drink or up at Todd as if nothing was out of the ordinary. And he'd go along with it, too. She was sure he would. They were in that phase of their relationship where he'd given her a ring, and they'd moved in together. And she could have just about anything she wanted. Except a baby. Are you joking or what? I'm no way even close to being ready for that. And plus the expense, Jesus. He was allergic. Hair, dander, fleas. And did she have any idea of what his parents had to spend on inhalers, injections, and the rest of it when he was a kid? She didn't. And at this point, she didn't care. Talk about impulse buying. The minute she walked through the door and saw them glittering there in their plexiglass cases, she knew she had to have one. The shop was called Herp's, and it was located on the fringe of the shopping district, where the fast food places were, and the auto supply, and a couple hole-in-the-wall Haitian and Cuban restaurants. She wouldn't even have noticed it, let alone pushed through the door, if she hadn't been so bored. Todd was having the car detailed, and he couldn't just leave it there and trust them to do the job. No, he had to look over their shoulders while they plied their rags and toothbrushes and sealants, making sure they were on top of it. And he liked to say that the two of them were a good match because she was an imperfectionist, which might have been passive-aggressive, but really wasn't far from the truth. So opposites attract. Wasn't that the way of biology? She'd been looking for a bar, thinking a mojito would brighten her afternoon. And when she saw the snake there in the window, thick as a truck tire and stretched out on an artificial branch canted up the floor at a 45-degree angle. It was chocolate-colored, with gold latticework that ran the length of it like a pattern in a catalog. Its eyes were hard and cold beads. Its tongue flicked in and out. Most of all, it was present in the way most things in this world definitely weren't. She stared at it for a long moment, falling into a kind of trance till the reflection of a car wheeling by on the street behind her brought her out of it. Of course, she'd seen snakes before at the zoo and nature films on TV, smeared across the blacktop on one country road or another. But she'd never really looked at one, not until now, when the abstraction and the actual fused into an idea, a want, a need, a sudden need so pressing it constricted her throat. She paused a moment to dig the Dasani bottle out of her purse and take a long, lukewarm swallow before she swung round and stepped inside.
And I really love that. And so Blue Skies, we should say, is a kind of companion piece to your 2000 novel, A Friend of the Earth.
Yes.
I mean, not exactly a sequel.
Yes, it's not a sequel, but I call it a companion piece because in Friend of the Earth, written in 2000, I projected to 2025 to see what the environment might be like. And so we have the fires, the floods, a pandemic, etc., all the way back from 2000. And this was kind of surprising to everybody. But now that we're here, and it is the daily reality, I wrote Blue Skies in order to see how we're dealing with it. How do we live with these conditions?
And you've been writing about man's relationship to the planet for decades. Did you imagine you'd still be having to write about the absurdity and the ways we keep on trashing our own home all these years later? I just want to throw in some not-so-cheerful statistics. The world's richest 1% have already used up their fair share of their global carbon budget for 2025. We've just lived through the hottest year on record. for land and oceans.
And further, Mia, we see in Europe and America the rise of fascism. You know, I was born in a democracy. I now live in a fascist dictatorship. The first thing that this president has done is cancel all green initiatives. So drill, baby, drill, just to make everything that much worse. I don't really have a lot of hope for the future. What I've done in my career is just try to assess who we are, what we are, why are we here? How come we animals are able to walk around and wear pants and dresses and talk on the internet and the other animals are not? It's been my obsession since I was young. I think if I hadn't become a novelist, I might have been happy to be a naturalist or a field biologist, go with some, meet some entomologists and go in the field with them. It's very exciting for me. I love to go hiking in places where other people are not. I don't like to hike with anyone except my dog, who rarely talks to me. I just want to experience nature in the way that we were meant to, and we very rarely do anymore. I need that peace, being an animal in nature. I'm always outside every day for a hike.
Well, I think you are a kind of biologist, except your main study, although you have written even from the point of view of animals occasionally, but your study is the human animal, right? The human animal and our relationship to our environment, society.
Address this, you know, since a friend of the earth, and everybody wants hope, and I don't have a whole lot of hope to give them. And yes, our species is responsible for all this destruction. But that doesn't mean that I'm a misanthrope. There are a couple of people I like, especially the women in the world. They're good. They're real good. Tried to work out all of these conundrums for myself in my fiction. And I've been fortunate enough that I have attracted an audience who wants to make these explorations with me. Again, you mentioned A Friend of the Earth and now Blue Skies. I'm not writing these books for advocacy. I'm advocating nothing. I mean, you can read the book and decide for yourself where I stand. But I don't think that art and advocacy really have anything to do with one another. Art is a free expression of the mind and an interpretation of the world. And I don't think it should try to point you in any direction to do anything. I don't want you to do anything except engage in art and enjoy it. That said, many of my contemporary writers are not concerned with the kind of issues we're talking about now, and that's fine. I always have been, though, and I am always writing something that is ecological or political. But again, I want to stress, I'm not advocating any course of action. I'd be happy if readers were more concerned with the environment. And what you had just said about how we are using up our green energy this year is terrible. So I'd be happy if people read my books and decided that we needed a greener planet and advocated for green initiatives. But that's not my object. My object is to figure out the world for myself as best I can.
Yeah, of course, there aren't. And the advocacy comes, I think, just from living in this world and understanding that we act absurdly. And, you know, I think at the same time, it kind of alleviates us from living in the world in some sense. But then I think when you go back to the world, then I think you have a sense of responsibility. I mean, that's my experience of it. And I think that no matter what the art is, I mean, it does inspire a kind of commitment to the planet in just that you actually use less energy when you're consuming art.
Yeah, I try to limit my footprint, although just having been an American in my generation, I've used far more resources than people who are not living in America. I do try to limit it. Everything on this property is natural. There are no pesticides, nothing like that, no lawn. It's just trees and it's growing on its own. I have a mulch pile. I mulch everything. I try to live close to the environment, but still, as an American, I'm doing incredible damage to the planet.
And of course, you famously live, and I believe the first Californian home designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And we were just saying before we began this conversation, so lucky that, you know, not been touched by the Californian fires on several occasions, because it's every year, right?
Right. We were fortunate this time. Just over 7 years ago, we had the Montecito disaster right here, which I've written about in the New Yorker and in my story, I Walk Between the Raindrops. We had a fire on the ridge above us. I could see the mountains right out here. And the Thomas Fire, it burned for a full month. Did not descend into Montecito. The firefighters kept it up in the chaparral. But A few days later, after the slopes had been denuded, we had the once-in-a-thousand-year storm that hit the mountain and precipitated this debris flow that wiped out a lot of the neighborhood, drove everything right to the sea, and killed 23 of my neighbors as well. I'm a transplant. I grew up in New York, and now I've lived here most of my life. And when we moved into this old house 32 years ago, there was the Northridge earthquake in L.A. that it's a big jolt, like a crash, and it just awakened us at, I don't know, 4:30 in the morning, whenever it was. And I didn't say to my wife, oh my God, it's an earthquake, run. I said, I told you we should have moved back to New York, but it's just a joke. This is our place. This is where we are. This is where I've made my life. And as you can see from my fiction, a lot of my books are set here, which brings us back to Blue Skies, you know, which is set in and around Santa Barbara and Florida, because I wanted to contrast us, you know, being a threat because there is no water, and then Floridians on the coast who are being inundated by sea level rise.
Yeah. And there's that moment, you know, you said you're not that hopeful, but there's that moment, I think there's some grace notes in the moment of hope, you know, towards the end.
Yes, I had to have some mercy on my characters. It's another interesting thing about being a novelist. This world, as we have discussed so far, is way out of control and dangerous and frightening. But when you create a novel, you are the god of that universe, and you can make anything happen. Yes, I want my characters to suffer, but at the end of Blue Skies, there is a grace note. Absolutely.
And so it's not all world's end, but you mentioned there, I Walk Between the Raindrops. So that's one of your short story collections. In addition, I think it's now over 30 books. You've read in so many novels and many short story collections. Are they sometimes seeds for the novels or a respite from the novels? Or, you know, how does that work for you creatively, you know, in terms of that latest collection?
And excellent question. And I will go with choice B. I am equally committed to the short story and the novel, which is unusual. Most novelists graduate from the short story and go on to writing novels. I've always stuck with the stories. I'm writing stories now. I've just finished the new novel, No Way Home, and I'm writing the new stories for the next collection. I kind of store up ideas when I'm writing a novel. You're locked into a novel, particularly if it's an historical novel. You're locked into a time and place, and all the crazy things that are happening right now cannot be addressed, really. So I set them aside and then try to address these things. If you look at collections, you'll see that many of the stories have to do with what's happening right now, issues of the moment. And yeah, I suppose it's a respite from longer fiction, but it's also an expression of my concerns, thoughts, hopes, fears in the moment.
Yeah, someone described it to me, the short stories, and I love the short story form, and I don't understand why. I don't know, publishers are against them. It just seems so suited for our time, right? But that they're kind of like flings, as opposed to the love affair of a novel or a trilogy, that kind of thing.
Well, I like to read a collection of stories and see the author going from one subject to the next as a whole. People want to have one big story, one long story. I can appreciate that, and I give them that. But I'm not writing in order to please anybody. I'm writing because this is what I need to do.
And just on that, is there a certain kind of character that is best suited for a short story? Like, they can't make that transition. I'm just wondering, is there a certain temperament?
In an author, you mean?
No, I'm just thinking about the kind of characters that can inhabit the waiting room of a novel as opposed to the waiting room of a short story.
Well, as you know, it's all a process of discovery. I don't know what a short story will be or a novel either. It just evolves day by day. The characters I guess most comfortable with are punks, young punks, because I was once a young punk. Now I guess I'm an old punk, and I feel comfortable with these characters, their anger at the world and how they think. But I've tried to stretch myself over the years. I've written realistic novels like San Miguel, for instance. And I've written from all points of view, all ethnicities, all different countries. If a story wants to be set in Scotland, for instance, like Swept Away, which, by the way, this story I love, it's like a folktale, but I've discovered that in the Shetland Islands is the windiest place on earth. That's all I knew. And so I did some research. And I had been, not the Shetland Isles, but close enough, in Oban in northern Scotland. And I wondered, so it's the windiest place. What does that mean? And so a story began to evolve for me. And it's one that I really like because I do love the folktale mode. And it sort of came out that way. In the mode of my heroes when I was learning to write, like Garcia Marquez or Italo Calvino, and I have no idea what the story is going to be. It's windy. It's the windiest place in the world. What does that mean?
So it's interesting how the imagination forms in certain landscapes. And I don't think you'd be able to guess from my face, but I'm part Irish and you have a very, very Irish name. I mean, I'm an Irish citizen, but I lived there for many years. They're natural storytellers. And I don't know how that's related to landscape, but it seems to me, and I know you are a musician as well, but in Ireland, it seemed like they didn't mind so much if they had a choice between making sense and making music. It was like, you know, as long as it sounds right.
Well, I lived in Ireland for a bit years ago, 3.5 months or so, in one little village. My daughter went to school there. I don't have any relatives. I don't even know who my grandfather was, where my grandfather was born. He did have an Irish accent. And I just felt I'd like to see what it is like. And it was quite magical for me to be there. My wife is kind of obsessed with ethnicity. When 23andMe emerged, she sent in a DNA sample. I refused, of course, because why would I want some corporation to have my DNA and start marketing me cures for diseases I didn't even know I had? In any case, she talked my son into doing it as well. Her profile showed zero Irish in her background, mainly German and Hungarian. But my son showed 45% Irish. So that gives me a good indication, doing the math, what my heritage is. And if the ethnic stereotypes are true, which they probably are, which is why we hate them, then the gift of gab, the gift for music, the gift for lyricism and words is something that I might have inherited.
And do you ever feel, because you've written a novel set in contemporary periods, like Blue Skies is contemporary and a bit towards the future, and then you seem to let go quite naturally into historical periods. Is that like an intuition? You're tapping a lot into your intuition. I mean, obviously you do research, but, you know, how do you grab hold of those voices when they're not in your own memory? Like, do you believe in this kind of like memory of going back generations?
Yeah, there is some kind of magic in the creative process. I am reaching for things in my unconscious that surprise me. I don't know what it's going to be. As far as historical novels are concerned, an idea comes to me, like The Road to Wellville, for instance, about the health food business. And I do some research, follow it, take notes. And then one day, a first line occurs to me, and I pursue it. I like to be able to do many, many things. It's all my life's work. But I don't want to just write the same book over and over again, as some other authors do. I don't want to become formulaic.
No, you definitely don't. But what I like, sometimes you read a bit of historical fiction and it feels like, oh God, this is so much research, and it kind of kills. It makes it not seem alive.
Exactly.
But I don't feel that with you. And the same thing like with Hilary Mantel, like, you know, it feels alive. Like it brings us there. And so,
yes, that's what fiction is supposed to do. And I think some authors get trapped in the research because the research is fascinating. And when have you got enough research? And you have to always ask yourself at a certain point, 3 months in, and you're taking notes every day, what is the purpose of this? Am I an historian or am I a novelist? And you have to realize that you are trying to create a story, and the historical facts, you want to be accurate. I do anyway. But yet, I'm not writing a history. I'm creating a story of real characters and what they might have been like and what they might have done and thought and how these movements, like the Road to Wellville, the health food movement, how it affects us today. So I don't know exactly why I choose a certain period, but something grabs me. Right now I'm looking for an idea for the next novel. I'm still writing the stories, but I'm looking for the next novel. I don't know what it's going to be. I hope it comes to me soon.
Yeah, and then you've also, which I love because a lot of people think it's a bit esoteric, but you've inhabited the voice of some animals. And sometimes, I mean, sometimes you hear these kind of like ridiculous things people say, like, oh, animals don't have language. I mean, I think animals have communication and they communicate and have a language that's not our grammar, but, you know, they're just like that you have that respect, because when I look at animals, sometimes it's more sophisticated. How do I know their tones and the light and all the vibrations they use?
Yes, well, it's about language, and I'm fascinated by that. So I've written two books of this mode. Talk to Me, which has a deaf heroine, and her language is perfectly adequate as ours. But we look down upon the deaf because they're not speaking to us properly. So I've traced what is language, how does it develop, and how does it affect this character? And in a way, Talk to Me about the teaching, trying to teach chimpanzees our language, is a companion to that book as well. What I learned from that book played out in this one as well, in Talk to Me. What does it mean? Can we communicate in our language with other species? Well, no, we can't, because they have their own language. You know, the apes were perfectly happy living in Africa, developing their own mainly gestural language, until another ape, us, came along and destroyed their environment, put them in cages, and made them talk to us so they can get fed. It's pretty horrible. And yet, as we study it more and more, animal communication goes far deeper than ours. And animal brains, too, like the chickadee, you know, putting away seeds during the summer, thousands of seeds in thousands of places, and yet can remember where they are. So it's just a question of, can we hold other animals to our standard, which is very prejudicial? So again, I had interest in these subjects, and I don't know really what to say about them unless I explore them in a work of fiction.
No, it's really fascinating, and I hope that you do more along these lines, because it's not done often enough and in an immersive way. I mean, it's not meant as advocacy, but we're not the only animals on this planet, but we're the most damaging.
Exactly. But you know, Mia, another along these lines of mine is a novella that tells the story, The Wild Boy of Aveyron. It's called Wild Child. I'd seen the movie when it came out, but I wrote the book 30 years later, and I purposely did not see the movie again. And it is a very fascinating story of this boy two centuries ago who was captured. No one knows what his story was. He had a scar on his throat, and it was presumed that living in a peasant family with a lot of children, starving, they took the boy out into the woods to mercifully put an end to him, but he survived. And he grew up on his own without language. And they captured him and brought him to Paris and tried to teach him our language with very mixed results. And I had a lot of fun with that, but also it helped deepen my ideas about language acquisition and what language means. Wild Child, about the wild child of Aveyron.
I haven't read that one, but one of your well-known books, I think, is the Tortilla Curtain. And it was written in 1995, but it could not be more relevant. I mean, the same, again, these issues you thought would be resolved are just, you talked about a new wave of fascism. Maybe set it up for those who haven't read the Tortilla Curtain, but Trump wants to rename the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of America.
Well, sadly, the Tortilla Curtain remains more relevant than ever, because the issues, not only have they not been resolved, and the issues are just simple humanitarian issues, but everything's been exacerbated by this right-wing takeover in America and in Europe as well. And there are 8 billion of us. It seems to me that what's happening is fascism is arising in order to keep other people out. Put up the wall, keep them out, let them starve. We don't care. That's our common humanity these days. And it's sad, it's tragic. I wrote the book 95 at a time when this issue wasn't quite so prominent as it is now, but it was beginning to be. Proposition 187, should illegal immigrants, you know, be able to have social services in this country? That was the question. I had just come from New York, where, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood that is left-leaning liberal. And I was kind of surprised by the native Californians' view of the immigrants from the South. They were very blasé about it, and they didn't really care. And so I wrote a book in order to explore it. And if the book has had an effect, it's often people will come up to me on the street or grocery store and say, you know, that book opened my eyes, and now I see all these laborers lined up outside this store. And I don't just dismiss them anymore. I think these are real human beings with real problems. How can you paint everybody with the same brush and say, as our great president says, they're rapists, they're criminals? You know, when you enter a novel and you meet them and you're inside their point of view and you see what they're doing and their struggles and their hopes, then you know at least one of them intimately. And that should change prejudicial viewpoint forever.
And I don't think it's giving too much away for it, because the white protagonist, you know, is the one he runs over. The Mexican character, it's such a metaphor in a microcosm of occupying or taking over Mexican land. And it can be applied anywhere. You could apply it in Israel-Palestine. You can apply it to things going on now.
Exactly.
If you were to write
yes.
a companion piece like Blue Skies of that, I mean, how would you, I don't want to say update it, but how would you continue that story?
I've never written a sequel directly. Should I address this question again now that it is forefront of the news? I mean, especially the last 2 weeks. If I moved to, I will find a way to do it, but it wouldn't be a sequel. It would be something that would be set right now.
Hi, I'm Kerry Trott, an English literature major at Chapman University in Orange, California. I'm so excited for you to hear my brief interview that I got to have with the esteemed author, T.C. Boyle. When I received the invitation to help produce this episode, I was greatly honored. T.C.'s work sheds light on a lot of topics that resonate with me. I love how his short stories and novels discuss current issues with a hilarious flair of absurdity and dark comedy. After hours spent in my literature classes studying Platonic concepts like the allegory of the cave, it's refreshing to read an author with stories that have a serious message yet allows the reader to laugh as well. These days, there is no shortage of despair. Every news headline portends a disaster and coaxes us to look away and crawl into our shell. I know it certainly does for me. Yet, the importance of fiction like TC's is to face these issues head on. Reading about a fictive world that prepares us for what our futures could become. Stories allow us to conceptualize the future while also giving an escape. Much like how George Orwell's 1984 still reverberates through the political and social landscape today, TC's work reminds us that the world is absurd, and the constructs that we make to tell us that it is not are merely facades waiting to be flipped on its head. In the following conversation, I will be discussing his first collection of short stories titled Descent of Man. I highly recommend you give it a read. It is rife with vivid imagery and is sure to delight all audiences. Let's get back to the interview.
So in the pause there, we were just talking about your life before being a writer. You were a musician, you play instruments, you're good, you're a singer. And then at some point you turned toward writing. But I think listening to your music, it doesn't quite explain your writing. It kind of gives a soundtrack to your writing or your different books. So I think it would be fun to hear one of your songs.
I would suggest that you play my version of I Put My Spell on You with the Ventilators. Put me down. I'll put a spell on you.
of y'all fooling around. Ain't gonna take none of y'all. Put me down. I'll put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
So great. That's the famous T.C. Boyle energy. Thank you.
Mr. Boyle, nice to meet you.
Call me T.C., by the way, since we're being friendly.
T.C. I enjoyed reading your work, and I read your collection, Descent of Man, to prepare for this interview, and I had a wonderful time with the short story collection. I wanted to ask you a couple questions pertaining to that.
Yes.
So first of all, I noticed just from, you know, we were talking earlier about reading short story collections as finding a through line through a lot of the stories and connecting them as one. And I saw, especially with your stories, Descent of Man and something like The Champ, you go a lot into masculinity and emasculation. And how do you see that, especially in Descent of Man, with being emasculated or having your pride be a little bit faltered by something like a chimpanzee having relations with your roommate?
Well, that is my first collection. I wrote it while I was still a student. I'm doing a lot of parody. I'm doing a lot of absurdist humor, black humor. Back to what Mia and I were talking about, it also has to do with our species' dominance over the other species, each of which has its own talents and desires and so on. And it comes down to the fact that we are all animals, no matter how much we try to deny it.
Absolutely. I really liked how you wrote about the differences in othering, where something like a chimp can be a popular coworker.
By the way, my favorite line opens the whole story in the whole book is, I was living with a woman who suddenly began to stink.
Yes.
The reader wonders, well, what is he talking about? Why is she stinking? And of course, she's stinking because she is working in an ape laboratory intimately with a very brilliant ape named Conrad.
Right.
Who is far more attractive than the guy she's living with, who is telling the story.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me to see how you detail how we're all so close. We're so much closer to nature than we really think we are. There's that scene that you write in the restaurant where they're quite literally in nature while they eat. And it's a very interesting comment. I'm so curious. You have such vivid descriptions, especially in that scene. It made my stomach churn. When you write something like that, where do you pull from? Because they're such vivid and almost grotesque images.
Yeah, absolutely. And my favorite part of that scene, of course, is, you know, the narrator doesn't know what's got his wife into this ape cult and so on and so on. And it is true, I had read, that some people do eat monkey brains. They shave the top of the skull. And so my favorite part of it is when he sticks his chopsticks and a little fist grabs his pant leg.
Yeah.
The table. So it's hilarious horror, you know? It's, who are we? Why would we do anything like this? How can we treat the other creatures as if they're worthless, as if they have no feelings, no emotions, and no even pain receptors for that matter?
I almost expand on that in the next story of that collection, The Champ, where you talk about this eating competition. How do you feel like those short stories connect as a writer? Do you go into those stories being like, these seem similar, let's put them together? Or is it just you like a particular set of stories and so you want to collect them?
So one of my teachers was John Cheever, who wrote novels and stories, but of course was far better as a story writer. When I was doing my first collection, I said, well, John, how do you arrange the stories? And he said, well, you take the best two or three up front and you save another of the best ones for last. How is it? In The Champ, it's a parody of a kind of boxing movies, of course.
Right.
And you know, what's interesting is since then, there are TV shows that exactly like the story. It's become real now. I like the idea of gluttony. You know, of me and I were talking earlier about how we're using up all the resources of the earth, of course. It's just a parody of the kind of movies that we've seen of The Champ, and he rises from the ring and wins the girl in the end. and wins the crown and everything else. Again, these early stories, just shaking it out. Not that I don't still do that. I mean, you can look at my most recent book of stories. And there are stories like that. I think in general, I'm maybe slightly less wild and more under control, yet I'm still obsessed with the same things.
Yeah, I definitely saw just how much you include a lot of the ideas of gluttony, conquest, and that sort of thing throughout your entire career. And it's absolutely fantastic. You have a wonderful sense of humor, and your writing is just wonderful to read.
My wife, who, by the way, was my college sweetheart, she pretty much ignores me. I'm just a household servant to her. And I say to her, well, you know, in the love columns, women say they want a man who has a sense of humor and likes to walk on the beach at sunset. Well, that's me. But she ignores me, and she doesn't want to walk on the beach at sunset.
Well, it was wonderful talking to you. I'm so honored. Thank
Likewise.
You so much.
Enjoy the class.
And I was just thinking about, we didn't talk about your being a musician. Do you still perform, or is your short stories a kind of way of doing singles? I mean, I don't know.
Wow, good question. Yes, I think it is like doing singles to do short stories. I gave up music a long time ago because I am not the kind of person who can do two things and do them well. I want to excel in one thing, and it takes my entire focus. So I was never really serious about music. I just enjoyed being in a band and doing my vocals, carrying on. But, you know, the other guys in the band knew that I was already, I'd written two books and that was my object in life. Yeah, why can't you do both? Well, I can't. I'm not the sort of person who can do both. I have to put 100% into what I'm doing and make it as good as I can. But I've never written a word without music playing in the background. And I listen to music pretty much all day long, except when I'm at the beach or hiking in the mountains here.
And there's a soundtrack that goes through your different books, I guess.
Yeah, many of the stories and novels come from the titles of songs. Water music, my first novel.
Yeah, water music, of course. And there's something anthemic, I think, about the short story, too, that has that resonance that I love for music. You talked about you live kind of in the woods. And then I also understand that then you go further out. It's not quite enough. You go further out when you're writing. Just tell us about your connection with the natural world.
I write every day, and sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't. But it confines me to sitting right here. Desk and a keyboard. When I'm done, I just go out into nature. Now, sometimes I'm doing yard work or hassling around or just walking the streets. But when I can, and here a lot, I go to the beach and walk on the beach and sit there, read a book, enjoy nature, see what's happening, just to see the pelicans crashing into the water or the seals. It's amazing. We would rent a place up there. I could just simply open the back door and be in the Sequoia National Forest. And I never went on any trails or anything else. I knew just everything there and where I wanted to go, my favorite waterfalls, my favorite spots. I'd walk out into the woods with the dog, maybe half an hour hike out someplace, and just stay there for the day. And I was not worrying about the bark beetles or the scientific names of the plants. I'm just like a child, just looking. Oh, look at that in my own mind. What? Wow. It's amazing. And go see what it is. I think that's really refreshing. And I know most people in the world don't have the opportunity to do that. Nature for them often is confined to the city. But I like to be totally alone in nature, to commune with nature in a way that's very basic. Sometimes I'll even, you know, take a nap out in the woods. Just close my eyes and let it happen.
I think it's the place where we can tune into the music of our own mind, and it can be hard in the city. I'm wondering, as much as your novels are about environmental, many of them are about environmental crisis or disconnection from nature, then you also have had this kind of commentary on technology and how it makes us unhappy.
I often in the stories, I address technological things that are happening right now. So this one, for instance, has Asleep at the Wheel, which the New Yorker published a couple of years ago. And it's my take on the coming revolution to fully automated cars and the banning of the driving individually around. That's going to happen eventually. What would that be like? What if this happens? What would it be like? So you'll find in the stories, as in the most recent book, you'll find several of them that have to do with what's happening right now technologically and what it promises for us, good or bad.
Indeed. And that it's not just about the future of driverless cars, because I think that is a metaphor, sleep at the wheel. It's like sort of when we're outsourcing our imagination and communication, creativity to AI, that's like we're kind of agreeing to be asleep at the wheel. It's dangerous. And I'm sure, like, I haven't tried it, but if I typed it to ChatGPT, I said, write me a T.C. Boyle story. I just want to know what your reflections are on that, because I find that that's a warning bells go off in my head.
I think for what AI is giving us now on the internet to do research, you need to know a specific fact at a specific moment. There it is. That's great. I haven't really had much experience with chatbots, although my fans on Twitter are always giving me little blocks of it, of what they're getting. I think it would be difficult to reproduce a novel that simply because the novel is coming from a single human being's experiences that, and the beauty of that, for better or worse, is that no one else has these experiences and no one else could be this individual. Otherwise, you could just have a committee writing books. I don't think it'd have that same spark.
I am concerned about the younger generation who don't know the difference. It's like fast food and real food. They grow up not knowing the difference between fake and real. And so I still believe in this physical world. And, you know, I don't think you'd say, I want to send an AI to make love to my wife.
Yeah, but where's the feeling, you know? Again, we talked about this at the beginning. This is what art is. Art is our individual expression of addressing the mystery. Who are we? Why are we here? Where are we? What does it mean? This is our conundrum. This is why we have art. We try to address these questions, and there are no answers to them. It's funny, every day, here we are sitting here having an interview. We write books, we talk. But the reality is, what's it all for? We want meaning. We want purpose. But there is purpose and there is meaning.
Yeah, and I do think we're kind of like that Sisyphus. You talked about being kind of punk and, you know, kind of jazz and I feel that you have this strong intuitive intelligence and that you're also a teacher for many years, a professor at USC. And you strike me also as someone who's very autodidactic. What did you tell your students or what are your hopes for education? That's changing from AI and the world.
It wasn't a problem because my PhD is in 19th century British literature, but they didn't want me to teach that. They wanted me to start a creative writing program, which is what I did. So essentially, I'm just holding creative writing workshops with my students. And we are all artists together and having a conversation like the one you and I are having now. Not exactly how you do it, but tapping the unconscious, making a work of art, examining it, talking about it, what is it doing for us, that sort of thing. It was a joy. I do miss it now. I haven't been doing it for some years at this point because LA is 70 miles away with grinding traffic every day. I was a road warrior, but I got tired of that. I still have my day job, though, which is writing books. It was a joy because I got to spend a couple of hours twice a week talking about what I most love with people who also have that love and to help stoke the love in them, if I could, for literature.
And what are your thoughts about the importance of literature and the arts, and also your thoughts about the future of literature? Some people speculate like we're going into an oral tradition with this multimedia in a way, perhaps, but there's still lovers of the book, and it's so important. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you see down the line, and what should we cherish about what we have and, our, and the importance of literature?
Literature and music as well, it gives us a basis. It gives us our humanity. I don't know what form it will be in the future, but we certainly need stories. We tell stories. Everybody, you know, the guy delivering the bread to the supermarket, well, he's telling a story to the guy picking up the bread at the supermarket. Everybody has to have stories. Stories build our psyche. We can't live without stories. I don't know how they're going to be delivered in the future. I am just doing what I'm going to do. One of my best friends is a painter, Pablo Campos, and he paints all day long, every day. That's what he does. This is his life. This is his joy. I am similar. I didn't want to go into music. I didn't want to write for films. I didn't want to do anything. I just want to create these works of art because they amaze me. I don't know what it will be. It's a puzzle. It's always a big puzzle. And when it's solved at the end, it's a joy. It's a, just a tremendous creative rush of joy. And so this is all I want to do. And I've been lucky enough that all my life, this is what I've done.
Yeah, and you're not a misanthrope at all. I mean, no one who's that dedicated to beauty and trying to understand us and all our human insanity could be misanthropic, because you wouldn't put yourself through that if you didn't care about it, us and the planet and all the other animals.
Oh, shucks, Mia. I think you're right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's satirical, but it's not all dystopian. And I think now would be a good time, because we've already heard an excerpt from one of your novels, just to hear part of one of your short stories, which is the other large part of your writing life. I believe you're going to read a short excerpt from Asleep at the Wheel.
Asleep at the Wheel. The purse. The car says this to her. Cindy, listen, I know you've got to get over to 1133 Hollister Avenue by 2 p.m. for your meeting with Rose Taylor of Taylor Levine and Rodriguez, LLP. But did you hear that Les Bourses is having a 30% off sale? And remember, they carry the complete Picard line you like, in particular that cute crossbody bag in fuchsia you had your eye on last week. They have two left in stock. They're moving along at just over the speed limit, which is what she's programmed the car for, trying to squeeze every minute out of the day, but at the same time wary of breaking the law. She takes a quick glance at her phone. It's 1:15, and she really wasn't planning on making any other stops aside from maybe picking up a sandwich to eat in the car. But as soon as Carly, that's what she calls her operating system, mentions the sale, she's envisioning the transaction, in and out. That's all it'll take, because she looked at the purse last week, but ultimately decided they wanted too much for it. In and out, that's all, and Carly will wait for her at the curb. I see you're looking at your phone. I'm just wondering if we'll have enough time. As long as you don't dawdle, you know what you want. Don't you? It's not as if you haven't already picked it out. You told me so yourself. And here, Carly loops in a recording of their conversation from the previous week, and Cindy listens to her own voice say, I love it, just love it, and it'll match my new heels perfectly. Okay, she says, thinking she'll forego the sandwich. But we have to make it quick. I'm showing no traffic and no obstruction of any kind. Good, she says, leans back in the seat and closes her eyes. It's the self-driving car. The car becomes judgmental of her also, as you'll see.
Well, I'm going to say, that's the famous T.C. Boyle energy. Because that's an interesting thing, because I can sometimes tell the physical age of a writer, and I can't tell your age, because you have a lot of energy in your writing voice.
Well, that's good to know, because it's good that the writing remains alive rather than dead and dull.
So just in closing, as you think about the future and the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what for you is the importance of the arts, and what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Exactly what we've talked about. Art and nature. Those are our salvations. It's not money. It's art and nature. And that's music, that's film, that's books, poetry. For those who can, I would say just go into the woods by yourself. Go on the beach by yourself. My favorite beach here is mainly deserted. I love everybody, but I see them plenty, but I don't want to see anybody when I'm in nature. And I don't want to hike, as I said earlier, with a buddy. I want to go alone, not have to talk to anybody or see anything except the birds in the trees.
Yeah, it's so true, and it's so important. Thank you, T.C. Boyle, for your writing that reveals the full complexity, absurdity, and madness hidden beneath the surface of the human animal. You've shown us in all our weird, paradoxical selves. As Blue Sky suggests, we may not avert the worst environmental outcomes, but at least we have art, and that's enough to make it all worthwhile. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
You're very welcome.
Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Carrie Trott, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Carrie Trott. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening. Ain't gonna take none of y'all.